Monster Man, special episode, Nomadic Monsters.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer James. If you'd like to be like James and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also receive my other podcast, Patron Deities, now on its 99th episode, where I go through the Deities and Demigod sourcebook for AD&D 1st Edition and look at all the gods, monsters, and mythological beings in it and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. So James, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. James has asked me to talk about nomadic monsters. We were kind of discussing a couple of different concepts, and eventually he settled on this one because, as he pointed out, in general, it's comparatively rare. We have only had a couple of monsters in the show so far that are truly nomadic. One example would be the Kryons from Creature Catalog, and we've had others that have some kind of like migratory quality. So an example of that would be Modrons, who have the Great Modron March, or Sharkkin, who have the weird compulsion to go on land, a bit like, you know, fish going upriver to spawn. But it's rare to find monsters that have a truly nomadic lifestyle. There are one or two. Seem to be a lot in the Creature Catalog, but I'm not sure why that is. So if we're going to talk about nomadic monsters, we're going to begin by talking about nomadic human cultures. And broadly speaking, there are a couple of different main types of nomadic economy. This is not a precise breakdown, but I think we can think of them in three ways. You know, first, you've got hunter-gatherers, and these are societies that move from place to place, taking seasonal advantage of wild food sources. So at certain times of the year, they might go to a coastal location to harvest shellfish, or they might go to a wooded location when the fruit that grow there are in season or whatever, right? So they move around, not staying in one place that long in order to avoid depleting natural resources, but also because different areas are going to have different levels of abundance of food supplies or of other materials or whatever at different times of the year. And hunter-gatherers often practice actually pretty extensive natural resource management. You know, it's they don't just walk up to places and accept the resources that they find. They do practice a good deal of control of those resources, whether that's by like planting particular plants they want to see grow or doing things like building fish traps. I mean, so, you know, the hard line between hunter-gatherer and like pastoralist or settled agrarian societies isn't really real, right? It's more of a spectrum. It's multiple spectrums. You've got societies that practice some kind of like pastoralist nomadism or like pastoralist transhumans. And that basically means that you have societies that rely on flocks or herds of animals as the core of their economy, and they move around with those animals. In particular, it's common for them to go from summer to winter pasture. That's very typical. And often you might find that that summer pasture is like in a higher location, and then they come down out of those colder areas for the winter and down to more sheltered areas. So you might have people who, you know, live part of the year in one area and the rest of the year in another one. Or they might move around a region completely. Like hunter-gatherers, they're attempting to avoid natural resource depletion, but in this case, the natural resource is grazing land. And finally, you've got itinerant groups. So these are people who move from place to place within a more broadly settled society. So examples of these might be like travelers in Ireland and the UK, or itinerant laborers, you know, so like typically itinerant farm laborers who move from place to place as different crops need to be harvested or planted or processed or whatever. You know, they don't necessarily have a settled home, although they might have some kind of like winter base or traveling circuses or whatever. And again, you know, these, I think that the sense in which we can call these nomads sort of depends on whether there is a distinctive culture. Well, I mean, that's if we were anthropologists and we wanted to make sure that we were clearly defining things, but we're not. We're just taking inspiration. So I feel okay classing these groups as in some way nomadic. Now, when we are creating a nomadic monster, we are not just trying to copy a human nomadic society. Firstly, that would be one of those examples of something that is just better done with a human, right? If a hobgoblin is basically a human, then Why not just be a human? And the other is that to some extent, this can replicate stereotypes about nomadic communities, right? You know, settled medieval communities sometimes thought of nomadic communities from like Central Asia or the Near East as monstrous, right? As barbarous, as threats. Although, you know, maybe not as much in real life as they do in literature. But I do think that even though we're not trying to exactly replicate how human nomadic societies work, we can look at them and attempt to draw some inspiration for monsters in the game. Some aspects of conflict between nomadic and settled communities. So examples of this could be things like nomads fearing encroachment on their migratory routes, or cities that are concerned about pillaging or raiding by nomads. I mean, these are common tensions. One of the most interesting things about nomadic monsters is that they reverse the usual balance of mobility in a fantasy RPG. You know, we would tend to think of PCs encountering monsters in situations where the PCs are mobile, but the monsters are stationary. Well, not stationary, but that monsters tend to be settled, whereas PCs tend to move around a lot. So the PCs are wanderers, they're, you know, wandering adventurers for hire or whatever, and then they go into the dungeon, the place where the monsters typically live. Although not necessarily, but in general, you are moving into a situation where the monsters are already there, rather than the other way around. So, some examples of things that you could do with nomadic monsters in a fantasy game. One thing that you could do is mess with the scale of the nomadic circuit. So, nomads don't wander aimlessly, right? Indeed, they wander very purposefully, so I guess that's not technically wandering. But they're not just, like, drifting through the desert or sailing along the coast, hoping that they will chance on, you know, food or work or natural resources. You know, that wouldn't work very well. They tend to have very carefully planned travel. I mean, they'd have to because of the limited resources that they have available to them. And what that means is that there's often kind of a cyclical element, right? You know, that they will be back in this part of the world the same time next year because the same seasonal whatever it is that they want is going to be there again, right? The grass will have grown again. The fruit will be ripe again. The pelts on the animals will be particularly thick at this time of the winter, you know, whatever it might be. But so when you have monsters who might be outside of those human constraints, like say you have monsters who are very, very long lived, you know, they might have a nomadic cycle that's long enough that it's not visible to mortals. You know, the community has a legend that hundreds of years ago, this monster came, you know, hundreds of years ago, creatures came out of the east and they fought these great heroes and then they headed off to the west. And, you know, in actuality, what they're doing is making a nomadic progress around the world. And when they finally get back to you, they're going to be very surprised at all these cities and farms in this place that, as far as they're concerned, they were just here the other day. You could even have creatures, I mean, this is kind of what the Great Modron March is. You could even have creatures that have a nomadic pattern that takes them through multiple planes. You go to different planes, and on all these planes, you hear the same story of these nomadic monsters. You can also do the same thing with size and, you know, the scale of resource exploitation. So, you know, like I said, nomadic cultures tend to move from place to place to allow natural resources to be replenished, often with help. So if you're a monster that consumes a lot of resources and you're intelligent, it makes sense never to completely eliminate the natural resources in an area. Now, we might have examples of, you know, bugbears or whatever, or bullywugs are just too sort of simple-minded and brutal. You know, they come down and they, like, drink all the beer and fight all the locals and gobble up all the plums. And then when the place is despoiled, they move on and they just attack the next place. And they never really think about coming back because, you know, bugbears don't really live that long on the whole. But if you're like a dragon, obviously you're going to be practicing more intelligent resource management strategies, especially if, as we said way back in a dragon special episode, dragons personify vices like greed. You obviously, you know, you're a dragon, you're going to emerge from your slumber, land on the mountaintop, look down into the fragile cities of men in the valley below, go down there and maraud and despoil and whatever. But you're not going to completely annihilate the place because, you know, a century from now when you emerge from your slumber, you also want there to be farmland for you to maraud across and cities for you to despoil. So you need to make sure that you kind of replant the area after you've devastated it. And again, if you're a dragon, this could be something like, you know, you establish an order of monks who are going to look after the place, or you also destroy an army of goblins that would have taken advantage of these cities in their weakened state. You can't have that. You know, you can't have these short-sighted fools messing with the habitat that you need to keep you in, you know, treasure and warm memories of slaughter. You can have more typical monster encounters that sort of partake of the kind of economic structure of nomadism. So, for example, you know, nomads in general will sometimes have a kind of home base that they'll return to, you know, especially like a winter quarters can be quite developed, but also a lot of the time are motivated by short-term needs. So just, you know, getting your whole traveling community fed for a couple of weeks can be a huge boon, you know, can really make a big difference in how successful the year is for you, which means that militarized nomads often have encounters with settled peoples that essentially amount to a kind of shakedown racket, where the nomads show up and expect to be hosted by that community, with the understanding being that this is how both sides prevent that being taken by force. And you can often have kind of societies where you have settled kind of lower classes with nomadic or like post-nomadic overlords. This is sort of what you get in the Seljuk Sultanates in the Middle Ages, right? Where you have a now settled but formerly nomadic and still nomadic in many like cultural and even technological ways, ruling class that is kind of fused with and ruling over these settled polities. It could be that, you know, every city knows that there's going to come a time, you know, that the caravan of these monsters is going to come through and demand a bunch of, you know, gold pieces and amphoras of wine and what have you. You can also sometimes connect the monster to the environment in interesting ways. So, for example, you might know how to find kobolds because you know that they always come down from the hills to hunt the beaver's comet giant in the winter because that's the time that they got the best pelt. This gives you something for the monsters to be doing. You know, envisioning those kind of nomadic activities allows you to have them be doing something other than just like chilling in the dungeon, raiding the surrounding landscape. Because in general, like, what we usually get is that some kind of tribe of humanoids have settled bandit-like in the upper levels of a local dungeon and have begun raiding the surrounding area. But those kinds of things are essentially untenable, right? Unless you have a very powerful bandit military force, you know, sooner or later they're going to have to move on or the authorities are going to arrive. And neither of those are very exciting outcomes for player characters. I guess the word for those kinds of, like, exploitative mobile ruling classes isn't really nomadic. They're what we would call peripatetic. And this is a model of even royalty that you see in the early Middle Ages, where royal courts, and indeed in the later Middle Ages, where royal courts are moving from place to place, essentially to kind of, you know, travel around the realm a little bit and also to more efficiently consume resources from all the different, like, royal estates. They're quite difficult to transport. But also, like, if you think about the bandits in The Magnificent Seven, they're kind of doing the same thing, right? That they sort of turn up at the village almost on a schedule to collect their tribute. The assumption being that, you know, wherever they're hiding out is not something that they can supply without doing this. This allows you to create a sense of foreshadowing or a kind of ticking clock with nomadic monsters, right? Because if the nomadic pathways of these monsters are well known, then people know that they are coming. And you can build up a sense of anticipation, you know, oh, it is nearly the feast day of St. Barnabas. That means that soon the ghoul horde will be upon us. So that can act as a time limit. We know that 10 nights from now, the ghoul horde will be upon us. And that means that everyone in town is going to cram into the temple because, of course, they can't tread on sacred ground, the brutes. And they're going to, like, leave a big pile of executed criminals and shipwrecked sailors out in front of the gates in hopes that the ghouls just eat those guys and leave the actual cemetery in which people's ancestors are buried alone. And this functions in one of two ways, right? First, it can serve as a ticking clock on activities elsewhere, right? Like, we need to get to the dungeon and back within 10 days because 10 days from now, the ghoul horde's going to come rampaging through the valley. Alternatively, it could almost be an opportunity. If everyone in town is going to be packed up in the temple during the time that the ghoul horde arrives, then it's going to be risky, but it's an excellent night to rob the corrupt burgomeister's house because we know where he's going to be and it's not at home. You know, in mentioning ghouls, I think it's the first example I've given of a weird resource, right? So in real life, nomadic cultures are usually looking for, you know, grazing land, game, or employment. But in a fantasy world, of course, they could be looking for divine blessings. They could be looking for blue jewels. They could be looking for spell components, you know, what have you. So the logic of their travel patterns need not be real world utilitarian stuff, because they could be doing things for magical reasons and possibly resources that are not accessible or visible to mortals in such a way that they could have become depleted or damaged or stolen or whatever, even without necessarily the people that have done it really knowing that that's what they've done.
So it could be the PCs who have done this, right, who have used up this resource without even knowing about it. Alternatively, if some resource that these people want is not normally available, they might wind up hiring the PCs to help in classic Dungeons & Dragons fashion. Nomadic cultures can also serve as kind of travel companions or guides, right? Like if you need to get to Blue Jewel City, then you book passage on the Gnome Express, or you get a job as a caravan guard for the Mutoid Exiles. Now, these are the people that travel a lot, and as a result, they have kind of the best knowledge of certain travel routes, particularly if you think about the kinds of areas where nomadic cultures tend to persist in, you know, pseudo-medieval landscapes. It tend to be landscapes that don't support settled agriculture. They're not wilderness, necessarily, but they're maybe places that you don't want to go traveling if you don't know the risks and whatever of those areas. And nomads might indeed earn some extra cash by, you know, acting as caravan guides, etc. And this, you know, in some ways could be another form of protection money, where those, you know, nomadic guides, like if you have the guide with you, then you're going to be okay because there's someone there who has essentially the necessary permits to take you through the territory of this nomadic culture. Now, the nomadic cultures typically have closely defined territories, but you know, if you are from outside that cultural context, you may find that, you know, whether the ship is a merchant or a pirate depends on how many guns your ship has. If we're looking for kind of like diplomatic role-playing aspects here, we may get some kind of clashing values. I feel like this is coming a little close to a story better told with humans, but you can definitely do it with intelligent monsters as well, right? Nomadic and settled cultures can often have different cultural principles, especially but not limited to ideas like, I don't know, land ownership and who has the right to restrict passage across particular areas of land, right? Because of the way that nomadic cultures exploit their resources, they tend not to have the same kinds of ideas of permanent land ownership that you find in a settled agrarian society, you know, because they don't use it in the same way. Like, if you look at how settled cultures tend to perceive nomadic cultures in our world, one thing is that you get the stereotype of like, oh, nomads are lazy, shiftless thieves. They're here today and they're gone tomorrow, you know, that's contrasted with the kind of patient hard work of the settled farmer. Alternatively, you maybe get a kind of flattering one. This is particularly true for kind of like steppe nomadic cultures, you know, people attribute to like the medieval Mongols these kind of superhuman qualities, but this idea that they are hardy outsiders, more in touch with nature than like the soft, degenerate city folk. I'm currently reading Jin Yang's second Legend of the Condor Heroes novel, A Bond Undone, and the Legend of the Condor Heroes books, so far, I'm halfway through the second one, I think there's 12 of them, very much have this kind of stereotype of Mongols, that's what they're like, right? They're a bluff, plain-spoken, hardy folk, you know, they live a simple life, but they are an honest and brave people, right? That kind of stuff. You know, this is actually something you don't see very much in D&D, but I think that you would absolutely have, right? If you have a society that people are in any way dissatisfied with, one of the things that they will do is attempt to project their criticisms of their society onto outsiders, right? So you can see this with examples like the Turkish letters, where the Turkish characters, the outsiders in French society, are made into a mouthpiece for criticisms of that society that they're visiting. And that's actually something that is often done with like Muslim outsiders. You know, this is one of the reasons that Saladin becomes this great symbol to medieval audiences, is this idea that he can kind of be used to like, oh, this guy is supposed to be our enemy, but if you look at him, he's actually got all these virtues. You know, what does it say that the people that we're supposed to be against have so many great qualities and we are so fallen, right? So this is a very traditional stick to beat contemporary societies with. And you can imagine, right, that there are definitely, like if you're in Star Trek or whatever, there are definitely humans who think that the Vulcan way is better. only the immense difficulty of gaining access to those teachings and like being accepted would stand in their way. Imagine if Klingons were real. There are a lot of people in our society who would say that, you know, we are weak and degenerate. We should actually be more like Klingons and have spiky boots and whatnot. The only example of this that you tend to find in Dungeons & Dragons adventures is people who like look up to vampires. And this is given as, you know, typically kind of as an example of the way in which vampires like bewitch and ensorcel their victims. But actually, I'm not so sure. I think if you spend your days working on Lord Ashmaw's dirt farm, receiving 1/10 of all the dirt that you grow, you might very well look at a bugbear and think, you know, that guy's got the right idea. Like, all he does is hit things with a mace and then sit with his foot up on a broken barrel and slap a goblin on the head. Like, that's the life. Just sitting there with your mace over one shoulder and a turkey leg in your other hand. Just, you know, gnawing on it with your tusks. It must be great to be a bugbear. I mean, it's not great to be a bugbear. You're going to wind up getting killed by adventurers, but that's maybe preferable to getting killed by bugbears. Like, at least they get to maraud a little bit. I've said maraud a lot in this episode, haven't I? It's a fun word. Anyway, my point is simply that, like, you know, maybe these people will wind up booking that spot at the Be More Bugbear retreat, or at least, like, hint to your neighbors that you might be a jackalware. I feel like there would be more identification with monsters among humans in a world where monsters provided this obvious other that could be contrasted with human civilization, or with sort of, you know, intelligent mortal civilization in general. I did have some characters like that in my fantasy game who were essentially elf wannabes. You know, I think that there's something there in terms of the way that we use others to express our own views about our own society. That's got nothing to do with nomadism, I'm sorry. But I do think that historically people have looked at nomads in that way. And there's a sense of freedom, right? People imagine this, what the other fella wants at the beginning of Conan the Barbarian, right? The open step, a swift horse, the wind in your hair. If you're in a settled society, then that settlement can feel a little bit like being tied down. And, you know, you think that you'd like to get out there and just be able to go wherever you want. Ignoring the fact that nomads don't go wherever they want. They go where they need to go, which is not the same thing, necessarily. So yeah, I think that, like, yeah, you can do nomadic monsters just by making your orcs, like, Dothraki or whatever. I mean, you don't need me to tell you anything about that. But I do think that there are more interesting things that you can do if you think about how nomads move from place to place and why, and then try to kind of, like, fantasy-ify those ideas, including doing things that you can do with monsters that you can't do with humans, like messing with the time scale. And I think that if you do that, you can probably create some fun monster encounters that you might not otherwise create, right? That would get outside the static confines of the dungeon or the relatively simple kind of, like, paramilitary outside the dungeon encounter where, you know, the orcs are besieging the village or whatever. Not that that's not fun, but I think, like, you can add a couple more colors to that picture. All right, that is about all the time that we have to talk about nomadic monsters today. James, thank you once again for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed your episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like James, remember, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we will be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.